We're very happy to have Dmitry Orlov joining us here tonight, and Dmitry is the author of the book Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. That's an award-winning book. He also has a new book coming out called The Five Stages of Collapse, Survivor's Toolkit. And Dmitry, I tell you, with this weather, you know, it seems like we should be talking about things that are kind of depressing like that. But at any rate, welcome to the Roadhouse.
Thank you. Great to be with you. And I hope I don't depress you at all.
I don't think you will. I think it already happened when I woke up this morning. But you're here as part of Northern Sustainability Symposium at Northhouse Folk School. You'll be giving a talk tomorrow night at 7:30 called Living with Collapse. You moved here from the USSR when you were 12 years old. That was like in the mid-70s?
That's right. It was 76.
So you kind of grew up with the Cold War just as we did at my age. And I don't know what kind of information you had as growing up, but I know here we didn't know much about Russians. We didn't know much about USSR. There was this big, you know, it's called the Iron Curtain, but it was a information suppressing cloud out there. So kind of grew up with fear and loathing of another people. When you moved over here, had those kinds of attitudes affected you at 12 years old?
Well, I wasn't paying too much attention to that, but yes, there was the usual propaganda about the homeless people starving on the streets and, you know, black people being lynched and, you know, various countries being bombed by the U.S. military. That was often in the news. Mm-hmm. But there was also an understanding that the United States is the land of Disney and bubblegum. So that kind of made up for it.
So there was more information coming to you than was coming to us probably about what the culture was like and the people were like.
Yes, absolutely, because the Russian cultural exports, of which there were quite a few, they were all very highbrow. It's mm-hmm. not something children paid attention to. There was the Russian ballet and various things like that, whereas the American cultural exports were very much aimed at children and were effective that way.
Okay. What was it like for you then as far as fitting in when you got over here? Was it a difficult adjustment?
Yes, I didn't really try to fit in very hard, and I probably didn't. I went to school and did the schoolwork and didn't really participate or contribute. So that was my solution.
Oh, okay, kind of back away from it and keep a distance?
Yeah, pretty much.
From the culture here?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you've gone back a number of times over the years and still remain, you know, ties to your relatives and friends over there. It was a huge shock, as I mentioned to Anne earlier, when the Soviet Union collapsed. How about, had you had seen that coming prior to what we would have felt?
I think so. I think I was one of the early people to recognize that it's all coming down and very quickly. But that was the year, pretty much the year or the year before it happened. I realized it was going to happen in 1990. It happened in 91. And I hadn't fully thought it through, but the reality hit me during the summer of 1990 when I was over there, when I realized that, you know, this is all sliding to oblivion at breakneck speed.
Do you think, as you look back, the USSR and the United States came out of World War II as the biggest players, and they may well have not been prior to that time. And then suddenly they became, instead of friends, enemies in the new stage, in a Cold War that lasted so many years. Do you think that was the how that kind of the symptoms that led to the collapse of the Soviet Union and may lead to the collapse of the United States, do you think they came from those events?
Well, yes, I think that this was a sort of a dysfunctional relationship. The U.S. and the USSR were frenemies. They loved to hate each other. Mm-hmm. They were very much in competition. It's very obvious that it wasn't just military competition, but the space race as well, and battle for the hearts and minds of places like North Korea and Vietnam and many, many countries around the world that went to one side or the other. And for a while there, the Soviet prescription was more successful than the American. In a lot of cases, it worked out better for the populations involved. Mm-hmm. So they actually competed pretty well. And Russia burnt itself out first. The Soviet Union burnt itself out because of its missionary zeal in spreading freedom and democracy around the world. And then after the Soviet Union collapsed, the U.S., kind of with the neocons and the Bush administration and people like that, started playing that game and started spreading its own brand of freedom and democracy around the world with similar results.
Maybe you could tell folks your ideas about some of the things that are have been the formula for collapse for the Soviet Union.
Well, yes. One of the biggest ones, of course, is having a runaway, out-of-control military whose budget just eats the national budget. Another one is having a very entrenched ruling elite that is above the law and cannot be prosecuted for crimes, which is in place here as well. Those are the two large ones that come to mind immediately. A political arrangement that cannot continue for extended periods of time, something that existed in both places.
I think everybody has been hearing over the last few years what a dysfunctional government we seem to have right now, and it doesn't appear to be changeable. And is that what you saw in the Soviet Union prior to their collapse?
Yes, the Soviet authorities pretty much became a joke before they realized it. So they were very self-important till the very end, but the people knew that they were pretty much a joke. And now in the U.S. we have opinion polls coming out that compare the popularity of the U.S. Congress to various things like, are they more or less popular than lice and cockroaches? And it turns out less popular.
Yeah.
Are they less popular than Nixon during Watergate? Again, less popular. Mm-hmm. Are they less popular than Genghis Khan? And again, they're less popular. So people are saying that's a pre-revolutionary situation. So why aren't people rebelling? Well, they're on food stamps. We have 50 million people on food stamps, going up by a few thousand every day. And as long as that keeps going, as long as they keep printing money to feed people, as long as they can do that, everything will be stable. But all bets are off once that's over.
I think a couple of the other things that you have brought up in your initial book was the shortfall of oil as on a regular basis, and then a trade deficit, a large trade deficit, and also just the foreign debt.
Yes, those are very, very important. Right now, the United States is going full steam with this program of mass delusion about energy independence and through fracking. And it completely ignoring the fact that they've overstated the reserves by ridiculous amounts, and the fact that these wells deplete by a huge percentage, well over half, in under a year. So this is a financial play that will play itself out relatively quickly. Now, in terms of the trade imbalance, the main export of the United States at this point is the U.S. dollar. They're running a printing press and exporting the U.S. dollar and trying to perpetuate the system that way. Now, that is not something that can continue forever. And things that can't continue forever generally don't.
Yeah. When we look at these kinds of problems and a collapse that in such an enormous size collapse in the Soviet Union, what was it like there right after the collapse? Was it totally dysfunctional? Was there still a government that worked for the people?
Well, the government did not work for the people. Some functions remained in place, but school teachers' salaries weren't being paid for a very long time. Hospitals kept running out of supplies. Various problems like that were just absolutely rampant. And the other thing that occurred is the rise of the mafia and various protection rackets, because the new way of doing business was completely illegal, so you couldn't count on what remained of the government for any sort of support. You had to come up with basically some kind of criminal organization to back you up, because your business was by definition criminal. So there was a lot of racketeering, a lot of mafia activity during the 90s, and a lot of people got hurt as a result.
I think you described the collapse of the Soviet Union as a soft collapse, as opposed to what you're predicting for the U.S. is a hard collapse. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, the Soviet Union was really Russia plus a bunch of republics. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, it was a background process to the reemergence of Russia as a country. There is no such entity in the United States that will reemerge once the United States, the federal structure of the United States, ceases to exist. You basically have the two coasts. You have some other parts of the country that are more or less homogeneous in some way. But there's a big division between North and South, even on the East Coast. So there isn't really this kernel that could emerge and become a new entity the way Russia did. And the other problem is that Russia still had a lot of the Soviet mechanisms in place, like public transportation, like the various utility mains that distributed power and heated the apartment buildings in which people lived. The fact that people lived or could continue to live in their housing free of charge, not paying rent when they couldn't, all of these things continued to function. Public education, public hospitals and clinics, all of that more or less remained intact on some level. There just isn't that much of that here. Here everything is privately supplied through commercial means, and that is a much more fragile arrangement.
We're speaking with Dmitry Orlov, and Dmitry is the author of an award-winning book called Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects, and his new book called The Five Stages of Collapse, Survivor's Toolkit, is coming out. How soon will we see that, Dmitry?
Well, there are 50 copies right in this town, and they're coming out basically one box at a time, but I expect that the people who pre-ordered it over the internet, they'll get their copies sometime during this month.
Now, I'm assuming when we see in the title Survivor's Toolkit that there is reason for optimism, or at least methods of mitigating what may happen. And are these what the new book is mainly about?
Yes. Basically, the thrust of the new book is collapse is underway. Realize that that's what's going on, and get over it and move on with your life such as it will be. And the important thing is to figure out what the necessary adaptations are. And to do that, I look at various groups that successfully survived various stages of collapse before, and I look at what made them successful in spite of what might be considered as dire circumstances.
So what we're looking at mainly is an individual choice, individual solutions, or at least in individual preparations?
Not really. I'm looking at groups, what groups can do. Not very large groups, but groups of individuals that basically know each other, all know each other. Right now, society is composed of a relationship between the individual and the state and various commercial arrangements. People might think that there's such a thing as the free market, but you know, the free market is a government scheme. People should realize that. Without law and order, free markets don't function. And law and order is imposed through violence by the government. So once that goes away, people have to trust each other and develop personal relationships instead of impersonal relationships based on finance or commerce or legal relationships and contracts. And so the Russians in particular were not very reliant on these official arrangements. There was a huge gray market, black market economy that operated. There were a lot of informal arrangements that people followed. Official contracts were de-emphasized, so they were well prepared. There are other groups that were also well prepared. The United States in general is not that well prepared in that way. They trust their government.
And one thing to think about, of course, right away is that with a collapse of government, paper money doesn't probably mean much.
Well, that is one of the largest problems that people here will have to deal with, is, you know, they'll realize that their money is no good anymore. You know, the printing press has been left on for too long, and now they can use it as kindling or bookmarks or whatever they like, but they can't buy their way out of anything with it. And furthermore, they can't pay for imports with it, so suddenly the imports dry up. So people will have to figure out how to use gift and barter and various types of informal arrangements and relationships to get what they need from people they know personally.
Of course, we're talking about this with the assumption that this is going to happen. Is there things that could happen that will halt the movement towards collapse?
Well, it could. There are things that could slow it down, but I think the trend is more or less irreversible. I think it's unfolding already as we speak. The numbers that I quoted, which is 50 million people on food stamps, there are other numbers to go with it in terms of how far gone this society is. The fact that there's the world's largest prison population in this country per capita, and in total, the U.S. imprisons more people as a percentage of population than Stalin did during the height of the gulags. That is just an amazing, astounding number. Add to that the fact that the government will no longer have money to pay for these prisons. All of these prisoners will have to be paroled and go back on the street. So what kind of an environment will that create for us once that happens?
Mm-hmm. In 2008, we saw a financial, not a total collapse, but we saw a financial recession, probably a depression that occurred, and that made the thoughts of collapse for the United States much more real than they might have been prior to that. We seem to have gone through a number of economic, perhaps bubbles or perhaps high points. Now we seem to be stabilized somewhat. Is speaking about a collapse a little more difficult to get across to people than it was during our big recession?
Well, there was a full-blown financial collapse in 2008. The financial arrangements that were in place before that point are gone. They're done. And the only reason that the banks are still open and the government is functioning is through an extend and pretend program of printing money and taking on debt of various kinds at various levels at an absolutely unsustainable rate. We're going into debt to the tune of $100 million an hour every day of every week. There's a limit to how long that can go on. It's definitely not something that can go on forever. And so what we're looking at is a concerted effort to pretend that things are okay and to defer the day of reckoning for as long as possible.
Now, we saw a lot of other countries, Western countries, go through even harder times than we did here in the United States over this period of time, since it seemed to be not just a U.S. crisis, but a crisis across the Western world. Do you feel that the collapse would be more than the United States involved and involve other countries that are similarly constructed?
Yes, I think that it would be more or less global, depending on how resource-dependent a country is. So one determinant of how deep the collapse is going to be is the per capita energy expenditure of a given country and whether it has enough energy resources of its own. So one very interesting data point is that Soviet energy production and oil production in particular peaked about 2-3 years before the Soviet Union collapsed. And conventional oil production in the world peaked in 2005, which was about 3 years before the financial collapse happened. These things tend to follow each other. But now all of the economies in the world are impaired to one extent or another because every time they try to grow, the price of energy goes up. Whenever it reaches about 6% of gross domestic product, there's another recessionary cycle that gets started. So that impairs growth in just about everywhere in the world and makes all of the financial arrangements that are based on the idea of growth impossible.
Which gets back to one of your initial criteria for symptoms that lead to collapse was the shortfall of oil.
Yes, that seems to be the canary in the industrial coal mine every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You live now on a sailboat and you and your wife do, and you also use bicycles to get around. Was this part of your individual process in preparation for changes in the world?
To some extent, yes, but also I just got very interested in sailing, and I wanted to just go and sail the world. So I bought a sailboat, and one thing leads to another. If you do that, then you find that you can't have a job anymore because that interferes with going sailing. So I quit my job. Once I did that, I realized that I had to sell the house and the car because that's just too much expense to keep going. And then once we did those things, then why would we stay in an expensive place like Boston? Why don't we just sail off somewhere where it's warm and sunny all the time? So one thing followed another. And I wouldn't say that it was that I was following any sort of program. It's just that's what happens to people who really get excited about ocean sailing.
The weekend down at North House is a sustainability symposium. There's going to be a lot of talk about different types of energy down there. Your talk that you're going to be giving tomorrow night, that's a 7:30 on Saturday night. What sorts of things will you be touching on in your talk that we are not covering here tonight?
I think we covered it pretty well, but I think what I want to really concentrate on is the mindset has to be different. People have to embrace the idea that they have to, in some ways, some subtle, some not so subtle, change who they are and how they approach each other, other people, what they're willing to entertain in terms of changes to their environment and to their circumstances. These are changes that are happening to more and more people, but I see that every day. But people think that these are all personal failings. These are things that happen to an unlucky place or an unlucky community or an unlucky person. They don't yet see it as something that is happening to the entire country and the entire world. And that's really something that I want to introduce, is this understanding that we're watching something perfectly normal and expected. Nothing wrong with it at all. Nothing wrong with you. It's just that this is what's happening now.
As people look at their lives, then they should be thinking the old adage, you know, live within your means. Is that more where we're getting with the attitude about life?
Well, I think you have to live within other people's means, and you have to live within the means of people who are poorer than you are. That's what people will have to realize, is that what yours is no longer yours because it's all based on commercial paradigms and financial arrangements that are pretty much out the window.
We've been speaking with Dmitry Orlov, and Dmitry is the author of the award-winning book Reinventing Collapse, The Soviet Example and American Prospects. He has a new book out, which is here in Grand Marais. You can get it if you attend North House Folk School's symposium this weekend. He's going to be speaking at 7:30 tomorrow night. Dmitry, I want to thank you so much for coming into the studio, talking to us, giving us your time, and for coming to Cook County.